Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled, You've Lost at the BIA, Now What? I'm JJ Area, AILA's Education and Resources Associate, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Thomas Ragland, a member of the AILA Federal Court Litigation Section Steering Committee from Washington, D.C. Joining Thomas is Maria E. Andrade, also a member of the AILA Federal Court Litigation Section Steering Committee from Boise, Idaho. And finally, Stacy Tolchin from Los Angeles, California. The speakers have selected some written materials for this podcast, which can be found in your AILA Agora digital library. Go to agora.aila.org and make sure you're signed in. On the top right of the page, you'll see a green button that says My Digital Library. Once on the page for your digital library, you'll see two files. One is the audio file, and right above or below, a resources file. If you have any questions, you can email agora@aila.org. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Thomas.
All right. Thank you, JJ. Before we launch into the substance, I just wanted to let people know the materials, specifically the materials that we've provided along with this presentation. And if you look, you'll find we have a PowerPoint presentation, which we're going to be going through, and you can refer to that as you're listening to the podcast if you like. We've also included a number of items. I'll just go through them in order that they're posted. The first is a post-BIA denial checklist that Maria has put together for us, and you'll see that it has 5 pages worth of just bullet points of considerations that you want to keep in mind in terms of when filing a petition for review with the circuit court. And if we have the opportunity, we'll go through some of those items during the presentation. After that, there is a document from specifically to the Ninth, specifically produced by the Ninth Circuit, but it's relevant, I think, for people practicing in any circuit, which is just do's and don'ts in practice for immigration practitioners, the things you want to, you know, definitely keep in mind as you're pursuing litigation in circuit court. Next, we have sample petitions for review from two different circuits, from the Ninth Circuit and from the Tenth Circuit. Obviously, and we'll go over this, you'd want to tailor your petition for review to the particular circuit where you're filing it. But these are a couple samples to look at. There is also a motion for stay of removal, or actually it's a supplemental motion for stay of removal from the Ninth Circuit to look at as a sample when we're talking about stays. And then there's a response to the government's request to lift a stay, which is also a Ninth Circuit pleading, just for purposes of reference. Two other documents we included, which are both AIC Legal Action Center practice advisories, one on how to file a petition for review, which is a very good nuts and bolts step-by-step process, and then who to sue and who to serve, which is a separate practice advisory on who you're going to name as defendants and how you're going to serve them as part of the petition for review process. All right? So without further ado, joined by Maria Andrade and Stacy Tolchin for this presentation, and we're going to start with Stacy discussing motion to reopen or petition for review, which should you file and why. Stacy?
Great. Thanks, Thomas. So once you've got your decision from the board, which is, of course, the Board of Immigration Appeals, the first thing you always need to remember is that if you're going to the Court of Appeals, you have 30 days to file a petition for review, and that's a mandatory period. So you always want to consider that first. The second option is a motion to reopen. Now, on the petition for review, that's a whole subject of a different conference as far as what all the requirements are, but the main thing you want to think of is, would you be losing out on any options if you forego the petition for review? So if you have any legal issues that are even recognizable or cognizable, then you definitely want to file that petition for review and not lose the options. But the Court of Appeals and the Board have concurrent jurisdiction. So you can have a petition for review that's filed within that 30 days, but also consider filing a motion to reopen. Now, the deadline for motion to reopen is 90 days. And typically the regulations require that there be new evidence, and we're going to talk about some other options as far as ineffective assistance of counsel and changes in law. The 90-day period, unlike the 30-day period for the petition for review, can be extended. It's subject to what we call equitable tolling, which we'll talk about in just a little bit. And there's also another exception, a couple more exceptions, where you may not be able to meet the 90 days, but that may be okay. Now, we've given you a site for Stone versus INS to be clear that you any issues you want to raise from the original case must be filed in the petition for review. So you can't forego the petition for review and then file a motion to reopen and hope to raise those issues. So a good example would be an asylum case. This board had denied asylum, but you want to file a motion to reopen based on eligibility for adjustment of status. That's fine, but if you want any challenge to that asylum decision, then you've got to file a direct petition for review of that decision and then concurrently file the motion to reopen, or else you'll lose options. Okay, so going to the next slide, if the motion to reopen is denied, you want to look first at timeliness. So the Supreme Court has a decision, Kukana or Kusana, depending on who you're speaking with, which reviewed the motions to reopen and found ultimately that they were subject to judicial review. Notably, the Kusana decision references the changes in the statute after IRA-IRA in September of 1996, which became effective in April of 1997. And so these are now statutory motions to reopen. So for the first time in 1997, effectively, the INA provided for a right of a motion to reopen, and that's in the statute, it's Section 240. These are what we call statutory motions to reopen. Under the statute, you have 90 days to file a motion to reopen. Under the statute, only one motion to reopen is allowed. And these are the motions that are still subject to tolling. So, and I believe there's one circuit that has found that's not the case. I don't think it's settled in all circuits. But for the most part, equitable tolling is acknowledged in most circuits. So equitable tolling is still a statutory motion, except for those cases where it's not recognized in the circuits. I believe it might be the Eighth Circuit, and it might be the Fourth or the Fifth, but I'm not sure. So that is what we call a statutory motion to reopen. Now, if you have a motion to reopen that is based on changed country conditions arising in the country of nationality, that is also a statutory motion to reopen because it's acknowledged in the INA, but there is no 90-day requirement. So, for instance, if you've got a case where somebody hypothetically applied for asylum and was denied by the board, and then 10 years later their family is arrested in their country, that might be a claim for a motion to reopen based on new evidence, based on changed conditions arising in the country of nationality, that would still be under the statute but would not be required under the 90-day deadline. Okay. So going to the next.
Let me interrupt you first.
Sure.
Give us an example of an equitable tolling argument you might make in the motion to reopen context. Something, not an asylum claim.
Sure. Yeah, I think, thank you. A classic example of equitable tolling would be ineffective assistance of counsel, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. So this would be a situation where, let's say, you get a case and the board or the immigration judge has denied the case, but then you review it and you realize that the attorney made an error. For instance, maybe the attorney didn't timely file an application for relief and, let's say, cancellation of removal, and then the immigration judge denied the claim because the application wasn't filed on time. So that would be a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. But then you need to account for all the time that's elapsed from the immigration judge's decision to when you get the case. And that's where equitable tolling comes in. So equitable tolling is asking the court or the board to toll the 90-day statute of limitations because the client was unable to file a timely motion to reopen. And that's when we look at tolling for purposes of each attorney that represented them. So if the client, for instance, did nothing from when they lost their case to hiring you 15 years later, that would be a hard case to make for equitable tolling. But if they were, let's say, represented by another attorney or two or three more attorneys who never identified the issue, that's where equitable tolling is really important. And so you want to document that the client was acting with due diligence and relying on the advice of these attorneys until they got to you, and so the error was not identified until you identified the error to the client. And that's your typical equitable tolling. There's other examples of where they were given misadvice, for instance, by INS officials. That's one option. And a new option that I've been seeing lately is if the client kept litigating their case and kept losing, so it wasn't their fault, but then the courts end up getting overturned because there's been so much upheaval regarding case law. So that's another option to look at for equitable tolling.
Great. Thanks.
Okay. So going to the following slide, now we're going to talk about regulatory motions to reopen. So remember under the statute that Congress provided that there's a 90-day requirement for motions to reopen with the exception of claims for asylum and withholding of removal if there's a changed country conditions arising in the country of nationality. But under the regulations, the board and the immigration judge have regulatory authority to reopen a case at any time. And that's what we call their sua sponte authority. So for the board, that's contained in the regulations at 1003.2. And for the immigration judge, it's at 1003.23. Now, this is an area that is very much in flux. So far, the Supreme Court has only addressed statutory motions to reopen and jurisdiction to review them. And in Kukana, there's a footnote that you can see in Note 18 where the court expresses no opinion on the ability of the courts of appeals to review denials of sua sponte motions to reopen. Now, most circuit courts have found that the discretionary decisions on motions to reopen are not subject to judicial review. And that's relying on a case called Heckler versus Cheney, which is interpreting the APA or the Administrative Procedure Act, which has a provision that says that when an agency decision is committed to discretion and there are no standards to apply, then no court can review them. So what's happened is that most of the circuit courts have found that there is no jurisdiction to review these discretionary decisions. So if you move to the next slide, you see that there's even more. We have the 10th, the 9th, the 8th, the 7th, the 5th, and the 3rd, and I believe there's more, finding that the Heckler versus Cheney precludes judicial review of denials of motions to sua sponte reopen. So what is a motion to sua sponte reopen? Here's a good example. Let's say your client had applied for adjustment of status and was denied on the basis of discretion. 3 or 4 years elapse, and let's say now the client is married to a U.S. citizen, let's say has a U.S. citizen child, and the child is ill or sick. That would be a good basis for a sua sponte reopening based on new evidence because it's new since the facts did not exist before the board of the IJ, and it goes to discretion. That is one of these areas that likely is totally discretionary because all of these cases that we've talked about basically find that this is a discretionary area. There's no legal standards to apply. There's a board case called Matter of JJ that says in order to reopen for sua sponte, there must be exceptional circumstances. And the courts have said, well, there are no legal standards that articulate what these exceptional circumstances are, and so therefore there's no judicial review. The open question, however, is the next slide, which is what if there are legal issues? So we've talked, going to the next slide, we've talked about new evidence of hardship, but there are a number of legal issues that come up. So two basic ones are if there's a vacated conviction or a change in law. Now, for the first, a vacated conviction, you're looking at a situation where, let's say, your client was denied cancellation of removal because of a conviction. So denied on an issue of statutory eligibility. And then you've got that conviction vacated based on legal grounds. And so you want to do a motion to reopen because now they're eligible for cancellation of removal. That will be a motion to sua sponte reopen. That would be a legal basis, right? And then another example is change in law. I'm sure all of you see this in your practice because the law is constantly changing every day in our area. So you have a client, let's say, who was ordered deported for a firearms offense, but then the law changed and is no longer deportable. And there's many, many examples that you can think of in that area. That would be a motion to sua sponte reopen because it's outside the 90 days based on a change in law. Also, a legal issue. Okay, so the question then is, And Maria, do you want me to hand this over to you then to talk about going to court on that?
Well, I think it's just one quick point before we go to some of the cases that have found a distinction. And one is back to sort of the line of cases that talks about heckler, and that there's no standard or no basis, no articulable standard against which the courts of appeals have found that they can judge whether or not an agency has abused its discretion. One point, and it's made nicely in an AIC practice advisory that we didn't include by Mary Kenny in June of 2013, is to just remember to keep, because it is an evolving issue, we want to keep our eyes out for cases, for guidance, for any sort of instruction or indication from the board that it is developing a body of guidances or factors that the own agency is purporting to consider when judging these motions, because, you know, maybe in a couple of years or 3 years from now, like, we'll be able to make a different argument. And, you know, I'd invite Thomas and Stacey to comment on whether or not you think there's any hope for that to happen, or whether we think that would be a successful strategy to at least try and get some review on those discretionary denials.
I think this area is very wide open. I actually think there's a lot of flaws with these original decisions applying Heckler versus Cheney, which say that there's no law to apply, because, in fact, the board does have a certain – there's two things. They do have certain standards they apply, but there's also an argument that they have a practice of granting certain cases. So I don't believe that it's just a totally discretionary issue. I actually think this is really ripe and worth really thinking about before foregoing a judicial review of any denials of sua sponte reopening.
Great. So this next slide, or the slide, I think it's the sixth one that we have, and the seventh one, talk about, well, how do we convince the court that there's some real legal or constitutional claim or something they can review that is embedded within a denial of a sua sponte motion to reopen. So if we think about Kukana, or if we think about the fact that what we're talking about here on the sua is a regulatory motion, so Congress has never spoken and said, hey, agency, we're giving you carte blanche to do whatever you want whenever you're faced with a sua sponte motion to reopen. Congress never said that because it's a completely regulatory animal. So where the decision is predicated on a statutory error, a legal error, there are openings to invite the Court of Appeals to exercise its jurisdiction. For example, let's say that an individual was denied adjustment of status. They were determined to be statutorily ineligible by a legal error, perhaps a mischaracterization of a disqualifying crime to be disqualifying, either because it's whatever, a drug crime or a crime of moral turpitude. And you would say, look, like if the board denies your sua sponte motion to your request for a sua sponte motion to reopen because they thought that there was no error below, that they had, because they got the law wrong, and that's the basis, the entire basis of their finding, then that opens the door to invite Court of Appeals review. And so the next slide, and Stacey, you may be more familiar with these cases, but the next slide has a sampling of cases from the Seventh and the Third and the Second Circuit, wherein it appears that the courts have expressed that, you know, hey, doesn't mean we're going to let constitutional or legal claims go by the wayside if that is, you know, the sole basis upon which there was a denial of a motion, because we always have jurisdiction to see if the law was correct. So that's all I really want to say about that side. If Stacey, if you have something more, it'd be helpful.
Yeah. So these cases, this is really a ripe area right now on review over sua sponte denials. So the Seventh Circuit, the Third, and the Second have published decisions saying that there is authority to review legal errors underlying. I think the Tenth Circuit has an unpublished case. I actually had a case we argued in February at the Ninth Circuit, so I'm waiting for a decision on that. But basically, the point of these cases is that there is no discretion to violate the law. and there are legal standards. Now, the issue of, you know, whether or not you've raised a legal issue is important. Some of these decisions address the board's finding that they don't have jurisdiction over a case, and they've all found that the issue of the board's jurisdiction is something they can review. Now, whether or not a change in law, for instance, is a legal issue, and whether or not the board, in a case called Matter of GD, set forth the legal standards to apply in adjudicating a motion, that's an open issue as well. But you'll note, if you go to the next slide, that cites a Sixth Circuit case called Rais, there's already a circuit split on this issue. So in Rais, the Sixth Circuit said that the authority for motions to reopen is regulatory, not statutory. And so 1252A2D is a statutory provision that says that notwithstanding any other statutory provision, the court has jurisdiction over legal and constitutional claims. And the Sixth Circuit says, well, the authority for sua sponte is purely regulatory, so 1252A2D can't apply. So we already see a circuit split on this issue. But I do want to point out, you can see a citation to Junelong, which is the Supreme Court case that many of you are familiar with regarding 212C eligibility, and an older case called Yang from 1996 from the Supreme Court. These are cases that apply APA review. And so these are cases where they look at whether or not the board's decision is arbitrary, capricious, and contrary to law. So every decision that the Courts of Appeals review of the board, the APA is injected into that analysis. And so I think you can't really distinguish the statute from the APA requirements, and so that the APA is always incorporated in. So I think we've got some good arguments on this, but it's definitely, you're going to be facing some litigation, because the government's position always on sua sponte denials is that the courts have no jurisdiction to review them.
Yeah, that's a good point, Stacey. The you know, the intersection between the APA, right, and the statute, because the APA specifically, right, we get the jurisdictional hook by 1331 jurisdiction or by a specific INA statute. But if you can't, if the INA statute precludes jurisdiction, then you can go in on 1331.
Well, 1331 would be for district court, but with Judulong, remember Judulong is a case where the petitioner in that case, the non-citizen, was deportable for sexual abuse of a minor, for an aggravated felony. And so there would be no jurisdiction under the statute to review discretionary issues or anything that wasn't legal and constitutional. But the entire analysis from the court is under the APA and whether the decision is arbitrary and capricious. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, especially I think also the cases coming out of the APA that talk about, like, look, the overwhelming presumption, you know, the guiding principles, that the overwhelming presumption should be in favor of review, that unless there's really clear and convincing evidence, that judicial review was foreclosed and Congress wanted that, you know, you've got to come forward with something more than just, you know, an assumption that this is okay to give to the agency. And that this subject of the APA working its way in is the subject of the AIC practice advisory that I mentioned earlier.
Great.
Mm-hmm. So let me pose this to both of you. For a practitioner who's wants to pursue an out-of-time motion to reopen and is skeptical that they're going to be successful in the administrative process and wants to preserve, to the extent possible, the ability to seek, you know, federal court review if they lose at the administrative level. What are the considerations in drafting that kind of motion? What do you want to make sure that you include so you can, to the extent possible, preserve the opportunity for judicial review down the road?
Marie, do I have a letter?
The first thing I would think about is I would try and pack my argument with to make it as, if there's a legal claim in there, a constitutional claim in there, then I would want to make sure and draft that. I would want to make sure and confront if it's going to the board, for instance, I confront the board with its prior decisions, whether they're unpublished or even if they're unpublished, to let them know they're developing a practice, say, in granting a motion to reopen in this type of situation. I would forecast any statutory right that is implicated by not granting it. But basically, I would be trying to set it up so that I could argue both that there is a legal or constitutional claim, and if possible, that my set of facts and issue fall within the category of cases that the board has been exercising its discretion in a sua sponte context to reopen.
Okay, great. Good. Okay. Anything else on this issue of motion denied pursuing a petition for review, try to review the motion?
The one thing to point out, just as many of you will think of motions to reconsider also, motions to reconsider, you know, will need to be filed within 30 days of a board or IJ decision. Again, just like we talked about with the interplay between petitions for review and motions to reopen, you need to file a direct appeal. So even if you've done a motion to reopen and the board denied it and you want to file a motion to reconsider, you need to file a petition for review of the denial of the motion to reopen if you want to preserve those claims. But because if you just file the motion to reconsider and that's denied, then the court's review will be limited to whether or not the board made any error of law or fact for purposes of the motion to reconsider. So it's all about preservation.
All right. So, Stacey, on that, let me ask a practical question. You've been unsuccessful at the board. You have 30 days to file your petition for review of the board's decision. You want to make sure to preserve the opportunity to review that. But at the same time, as we've discussed, you do think you have a good argument for a motion to reconsider or a motion to reopen. Let's say you file your petition for review. The circuit court has jurisdiction over it. Then you file a motion to reopen with the BIA. What's the circuit court going to do with your petition?
Right, so I think that's a great point. It depends, of course, what circuit you're in and how fast things move. It's very different across the country. But what you can do is talk to your opposing counsel, so usually the Office of Immigration Litigation or OIL, and discuss holding the petition for review in the first case so that the board can rule in the second case. And then if there's a denial, then the two petitions for review would be consolidated so you can file one brief together. So you can either get a stipulation or a joint motion from OIL, or you can just file a motion on your own to hold the briefing in abeyance on the first case, and hopefully it'll be unopposed. Most of the time I found OIL is amenable to this because otherwise it doesn't quite make sense. You've got two sets of opening briefs floating around, and it's sort of a waste of resources.
And Thomas, that's also been my experience in that exact same situation, that at some point somebody realizes they don't want to do double briefing, but it just doesn't make sense either. You want to bring them all together in most actions, and OIL's been agreeable.
Right, and also from the court's perspective, they want the issues to be fully resolved administratively, and if there's a possibility that the board is going to reopen a case and deal with it, and they don't have to, I've never found a circuit court so eager to do work on a case that they'd be unwilling to hold it in abeyance to see whether it can be resolved at the administrative level.
Right. This might be a good time, Thomas, maybe to mention we've gone through sort of some initial considerations have been mentioned already that are on this post-BIA denial checklist. One of the things that we didn't mention that should go through your mind when you get that board denial, you know, you got the 30 days you're thinking about, but you also, I think it's important to remember, you've got to communicate that decision immediately to your client. And it's not just because they want to know what's going on, but because you've got to make sure, like you may decide after looking at it, like for who knows why you don't want to do that case, but you've got to be able to communicate whatever decisions are made to the client soon enough for the client to have time to go out and find alternate counsel. We have seen a few cases come across our desk where we see that this was somebody missed out on a petition for review because they were told at the last minute that their lawyer was not going to do the case, and you know, getting someone to do that for you or doing it pro se is really difficult. And then the other, there's some random considerations that are on the first couple of pages as to whether or not you want to file the case, and some of them have to do with the type of client you have and whether they're a good fit for federal litigation and, you know, kind of their commitment to the case and whether you guys see it the same way. Do you see it as you're going for a legal win? Do you see it going for some more public campaign or maybe impact litigation? You know, fees are always an issue. How are you going to pay for the case? Do you think you're going to get EJIA fees? Are you able to do it without regard to fees? And then as the next couple of the slides coming up, we'll get into, you know, what are some potential resolution short of full litigation, you know, might you have an opportunity to get something resolved in mediation or through an agreement. But be careful if you're counting on that. If you're filing litigation, counting on getting some you know, prosecutorial discretion, you know, that's sort of dangerous territory. So anyway, you want to take maybe a little gander at the first couple of pages of the checklist that'll take you through some things to think about at this stage when you're just really thinking about filing and the claim and whether you want to do it and the client and all of those various considerations.
Okay, great. I think that's very important that you've got sort of competing considerations here. Number one, you've got the statutory 30-day time frame within which to file a petition for review, and if, as you say, if you miss that, you're out of luck. There's no equitable tolling of that period, and keep in mind that a decision from the Board of Immigration Appeals that's mailed to you could take a week to arrive, and at that point, you've got only 3 weeks left, roughly, to prepare and file your petition for review. Now, just pointing out the sample petitions for review that we've included in the materials, for those who haven't filed them before, the petition for review itself is a pretty simple filing. It's about a 1 or 2 page document that you file with the court that is essentially gets you on record as seeking review of the issue. It does not require a brief to be included with it, unlike some other types of filings you might be familiar with to the AAO or wherever. The petition for review gets your appeal docketed, and then the court will issue a briefing schedule for the issues to be briefed. So it's not an excuse to say, well, I don't have time to prepare a petition for review within that 30-day window. If there's a petition for review to be filed, you should be able to get it filed. Now, other considerations I think that are important to keep in mind are not every issue, not every BIA decision is appropriate for review in the circuit courts. It's a different topic altogether, but if you look at 8 U.S.C. 1252 or Section 242 of the INA, there are specific issues over which the circuit courts do not have jurisdiction, discretionary issues, certain criminal issues, and there's fuller guidance on that. But as an attorney, you need to look and see, is this an issue that the court can review, or am I wasting the client's time and money to take a petition for review to the circuit court? Also, if a client comes to you and has had another attorney up to that point and yet wants to now bring a petition for review, you need to look at the underlying materials and see whether the issues you might want to raise to the circuit court have been preserved in the underlying litigation before the immigration judge, before the Board of Immigration Appeals. Otherwise, you could have great issues and the petition will be dismissed for failure to preserve those issues for appeal. Just considerations to keep in mind as the attorney filing this, you don't want to just willy-nilly file, and you also don't want to miss your deadline. Okay, anything else on that, or should we move on?
No, that's great.
Okay, so next we want to talk about what happens in the event that your client got an order of voluntary departure. What happens to voluntary departure when you file a petition for review? And there's a specific, the answers in the regs, there's a specific regulation that's on this slide, the next slide, in that's titled Voluntary Departure and Petitions for Review. Under 8 CFR 1240.26D, a grant of voluntary departure automatically terminates upon the filing of a petition for review, except to the extent that the alien who's been granted voluntary departure departs the United States no later than 30 days following the filing of the petition for review and therefore won't violate their voluntary departure order as long as they provide evidence when they return to their country that they have departed and they're outside the United States. So in other words, filing a petition for review will terminate your voluntary departure period, but that won't automatically convert into a removal order so long as your client does physically depart the United States and provides proof of having departed within 30 days of filing a petition for review. And then a petition for review can be pursued from outside the United States. Your client doesn't need to be in the United States to continue to pursue the petition for review in the circuit court.
And Thomas, can I just add that I always think that immigration attorneys are a little overzealous about voluntary departure. It does provide the opportunity to avoid the entry of removal order. But remember, when you're taking voluntary departure, you always need to analyze those unlawful presence bars, because frequently people don't recognize that for a client who's been here unlawfully for more than a year, if they depart, even under a voluntary departure order, they still trigger that 10-year bar to coming back. And so a lot of times we see sort of the miscalculation that voluntary departure might be helping the client, when in fact instructing the client to leave would trigger those 10-year bars, and in some cases they may not even be eligible for waivers to come back.
No, I think it's a very important consideration. I usually say to clients, look, I don't recommend taking voluntary departure unless you really intend to leave within the, whatever it is, the 30-day period or the period that the judge provides, because taking voluntary departure and then failing to depart not only results in it automatically it converts into a removal order, but then there are also bars to discretionary forms of relief for failing to depart under an order of voluntary departure.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think the only time to take voluntary departure is if you have immediate plans on how your client can come back to the United States, and hopefully that they're not triggering those unlawful presence bars. Because otherwise, to be honest, it really is not a benefit for your client.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, we've sort of changed how we address voluntary departure, but the overzealousness is still a remnant among a lot of practitioners who, you know, for years they're not nearly as severe penalties, and certainly not statutory ones. And we've all seen cases go on for a long time in litigation, and the law changes, people's personal circumstances change, and suddenly someone poof is eligible to adjust. And if they overstay their voluntary departure now, they're not going to be able to do that under the bars.
All right, good points. Let's move to the next slide, and this is somewhat of a general slide and some of the things we may have already touched on, but when you're deciding, and I mentioned this, when you're deciding whether to take a case and file a petition for review, whether you've litigated it below or whether the client's come to you and is asking you to do the federal court work, things you need to keep in mind before deciding, in advising the client whether they should file a petition for review, because I find often the default for many attorneys as well, we've lost the BIA, now we've got 30 days to file a petition for review, send me some more money, we'll file a PFR, and it's just really not appropriate in every case. And as an attorney, you have the duty to properly advise the client of the likelihood of success or whether there's even a viable argument to be made on a petition for review. So jurisdiction is a big consideration. Again, you want to look at Section 242 of the INA, which is the jurisdictional authority to review decisions, removal decisions, immigration decisions in the federal courts, and keep in mind that certain areas jurisdiction has been stripped. Jurisdiction was reinstated after IRIRA in 1996. The Real ID Act reinstated jurisdiction over constitutional issues and questions of law. And so again, this can get quite nuanced and detailed, determining whether there is a constitutional issue or question of law that can be pursued, or whether what you have is a pure discretionary issue not subject to review, or a criminal ground of removal that's not subject to review. So that jurisdiction issue needs to be fully investigated before filing the petition. Number two, maybe this should be number one. Always have a legal theory. And again, it doesn't need to be black letter that you're going to. I don't want to discourage people from filing petitions where there is an argument to be made, a non-frivolous argument, even if the law is against you and you're trying to sort of push the envelope on development of the law. That can be a legitimate basis to file a petition for review. But as with all things, you need to do the research and work out the theory before filing the petition. Did you want to say something about that, Maria?
Oh, I was just no. Go ahead. the one thing we were talking about, make sure you have a jurisdictional hook. You know, the other sort of side note is, you know, remain open to the possibility that your client is better served by somebody else. for whatever reason. It's just something I think that escapes the radar to stop and just think about that for a minute. Maybe there's an ineffective assistance claim, you know, that the client ought to pursue with somebody else. Maybe you kind of haven't had a great relationship working with them thus far, and it's just labored to continue. But those are just some sort of other side issues in the initial considerations that I think have to do with sort of the ethics and professional responsibility that considerations that surround this decision.
Yeah, and we have a good handout that you have included in the information here, but we know at least, we just did a seminar recently with the Ninth Circuit, they have a list of bad apples, they call them, and so they know if you're repeatedly filing cases where there's no jurisdiction, or if you're filing cases and there's orders to show cause issued based on lack of jurisdiction and you're not responding, things like that, and you know, you don't want to make a practice of that, you want to have a good reputation for yourself and for your clients going forward.
And the other thing that's important to keep in mind is filing a petition for review is not the end of the story. You then have to brief the case. And so on the assumption that as a good attorney, you're not going to do this unless you're, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound, you're going to put all the work in that's required to try to zealously represent your client and win the case on appeal, it's a lot of work. So you want to figure out for yourself the amount of time it's going to take for you to do the research and writing and filing of an opening brief and then a reply brief, and in the event the case is scheduled for oral argument, preparing for that and presenting the oral argument to the court, and making sure that you're covered on that. Either you've decided I'm going to do this and not get paid for it and I'm okay with that, or I'm going to offer some, you know, some lower costs and I'm okay with that, or the client's going to be able to pay every penny and therefore I'm not concerned about spending the time I'll need to take to litigate this. The bottom line being, don't file a petition for review unless you're prepared to zealously litigate the case. There's another bullet point on here which sort of goes along with that, I guess, which is never file a petition pro se if you're getting paid to handle the case. You need to enter your appearance. You need to be the attorney of record. If you're handling the case, and I would say that goes, you know, even if you're not getting paid and you decide to do the case pro bono, take ownership of it and put your name on it and enter your appearance as the attorney of record.
Yeah, Thomas, I think that's a great point. I think, you know, there's some issues. It's a different situation if it's a nonprofit organization, and I know that a lot of times nonprofit organizations, legal services organizations, are helping people, but ultimately the client's filing pro se. But if you're an individual attorney in private practice and you're providing legal assistance, then you need to put your name on the document. This is a particularly pet peeve in Los Angeles because I've frequently heard attorneys say, well, the client really couldn't pay me my full amount of what I needed, so I just took some money, less than I normally would take, but then filed pro se. And that's just, I think that's unethical and it's a violation of the court rules. If you need to put your name on if you're doing the work.
Very good. All right, let's move on to stays. Stays or removal. Maria, you want to launch off on this one? Let's talk about Ken versus Holder.
Sure. So there was a sea change in stays, at least in our circuit, in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, with the Supreme Court decision of Meekin v. Holder, that set forth this four-factor test that needs to be established by the petitioner seeking a stay. And, you know, sort of the factors on their face, they don't seem like they're, like, you know, they seem reasonable to an extent. But the rub in, I think, these four factors that has come to light after Meekin goes to the irreparable injury factor. So you have to show four things, you know, whether the stay applicant has made a strong showing that they're going to succeed on the merits. That is going to now require a bit of substantial briefing on the merits, you know, whether they'll be irreparably injured if they don't get the stay, and sort of like where the public interest lies, and then, you know, whether the stay will injure the people who want to move forward or the government. And so the one issue takeaway, which you'll see explained, briefed at, you know, pretty substantially in the sample briefing in the supplemental stay motion, is that the the government attorneys in front of the Supreme Court represented to the Supreme Court that there was this return policy. If you prevailed, they said, look, the irreparable injury, not such a big deal, because if you prevail before the Court of Appeals, we can bring it back. And we can bring it back, and it'll be like, you know, it'll be really easy. It was later discovered in FOIA litigation that in fact, there really, at best, there's an inconsistent policy. At worst, there was no policy in effect at the time, and that has been made public and known to the Supreme Court. But in the interim, different courts of appeals have taken the Nikin standard and sort of adjusted their own prior Nikin holdings to adjust to Nikin. So what you see in the sample pleadings is an argument that I will admit has yet to be successful, an argument that the Ninth Circuit ought not make its stay standards more difficult, at least to the extent that they believe that there's less chance of irreparable injury if the stay isn't granted on a presumption that the successful litigant will be easily returned because of the now public information that there is no return policy. So you'll see those factors in sort of an argument you can lay out, and I hope someone wins that at some point, but I have not seen it be successful, which leads us to sort of the point that we were discussing in preparing this call is, you know, now what do people do about stays? We used to regularly apply for a stay with the filing of a petition for review. You will see a sample of that in the materials. It's in the Ninth Circuit, there was a case and ultimately memorialized into a local rule that said, you know, you can get this temporary stay. But if you do that now, in light of Nikin, you need to actually come forward with additional information to really make that full showing that you meet the Nikin standards. Every once in a while, you'll get lucky and the government won't oppose that temporary stay. But you still may get called upon to brief it, and you should still really be prepared to brief it. And all of this is boiling down to a reconsideration of whether we're ever going to really ask affirmatively for stays, because I think I'll pass back to you, Stacey, is there's at least in our jurisdiction, we have not felt a lot of pressure from ICE to actually go out and remove individuals who are actively litigating their cases who aren't otherwise detained if they don't have a stay. So we're beginning to rethink whether or not we're going to be asking affirmatively stays for anybody unless we think they're really at danger of being imminently removed. So I'd love to hear your other comments from Thomas as well.
Well, so this is Stacey. So I'm in Los Angeles, and as a matter of course, until last week, it was our policy to file petitions for review and to not file stays unless we believed the client was in danger of imminent removal, which really meant, were they detained? But for those cases where they weren't detained, it was regular policy just to have the person, even on orders of supervision, they would just go in and show that there was a case pending before the Court of Appeals and get ordered a report for 6 months. No problems at all. Last week, that ended for a client of mine who we've been litigating a case for 7 years, and they took him in. And we're trying to figure out what's going on. But there, we did find some testimony from 2 weeks ago of DHS and officials before a Senate subcommittee basically on their failure of DHS to enforce the law. And so I'm a little concerned that they may be being more aggressive just given the politics right now leading up to the election. And so while it has certainly been our policy not to file stays, I may be rethinking that in the next few weeks. So as you all listen to this podcast, we will see how events turn.
And Stacey, can I ask you, was the client who was taken in, was that somebody reporting like on an order of supervision?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so these are important considerations to keep in mind, even in the Ninth Circuit, which tells you something, that it's possible that you'll need to file an affirmative stay to be able to keep your client in the country while you're litigating this. And just to step back for a minute, as practitioners know, when you file an appeal with the Board of Immigration Appeals, you have an automatic stay of removal. Not so in filing a petition for review in the circuit court. There's no automatic stay. As Maria mentioned, and it's been my experience to a substantial degree, that if a client is actively litigating their case, the ICE enforcement removal operations folks are less motivated maybe to go after them unless there is some issue involved, like a violent crime, or it's a petition from an administrative 238 removal proceedings where there was an aggravated felony conviction. But otherwise, I think from ICE's perspective, they want the case to be done and done. They want it to be final before they expend the effort to try to report somebody. Having said that, as the attorney advising the client, I think you want to tell them that there is a possibility that a stay will need to be filed, that in the event they get picked up or when they go to report on their order, they're taken into custody. As the attorney, you want to be ready to file a stay right away. So you might discuss with the client and say, look, I'm going to prepare a prophylactic stay of removal, and I'm going to keep it, and I'm going to file it if necessary. Maybe we won't need to, but you don't want to be without one in the event that something happens. It's just a consideration to keep in mind depending on, you know, what your client's circumstances are. But my practice also has been not to file a stay unless you need to, unless you feel like the client's at imminent risk of removal. The reason being that if you do file a stay and the court denies it, there's nothing standing in the way of ICE moving on your client. So the theory being, don't ask for it unless you really need it. Okay. Anything else on stays?
No, I don't think so.
Nothing else.
It, you know, outside the Ninth Circuit and other circuits, obviously you want to check and look at what are the standards. The Inken standards are, you know, it's the Supreme Court, so it's pretty applicable, but within each circuit, the circuit will have authority on, it will have decisions, published decisions on stays that are granted, stays that are denied, and you obviously want to look at, in the Fourth Circuit, you want to look at their standards, in the Fifth, you want to look at theirs and see as you're preparing your stay motion that you're tracking what's required in your particular circuit. All right. The next slide is how to effectively deal with the Office of Immigration Litigation. OIL is the office in the Department of Justice that represents the government and defends the decision of typically the Board of Immigration Appeals in the circuit court on a petition for review. And you'll end up dealing with the OIL attorney who's assigned to the case. No matter what happens in the petition, even if it's just straight briefing, but there are other possibilities besides briefing an argument and proceeding to a decision from the court. And again, let's, Stacey, in the Ninth Circuit, you have a mediation program. How does that work?
We do have a mediation program, but in general, the mediation program has kind of taken a step back and said, okay, we want the parties to work this out themselves. So the program now, essentially, if you do a request for mediation, what they'll usually do is deny the request and give you 90 days to basically stay the case. And then you can renew the request if you really do need mediation. But I think the court was finding that they were essentially just sort of babysitting cases. So you can do what mediation sort of helped you with just by talking to opposing counsel.
Yeah, I've always thought mediation is a little odd in immigration cases because typical mediation, you know, there can be a meeting of the minds. We're going to agree upon this sum of money to resolve, you know, whatever the complaint of damages are. In the immigration context, either you're going to deport my guy or you're not going to. And so I think it's hard to reach middle ground there.
Right, but there are definitely things that we're able to do. For instance, you know, let's say holding briefing in abeyance because there's a pending motion to reopen or because, you know, there's a lead case that may address your issue. And so, you know, you don't want to do briefing until that's addressed. Things like that. And even prosecutorial discretion, which we can talk about a little bit more. I mean, those are things that you really, you know, we used to use the mediation program for, but really it's just about talking to opposing counsel. And I think for the most part, OIL's been relatively amenable to some of those things. It ultimately always comes down to if your client has significant crimes or not.
Okay, what about if either you or the government suggests remanding the case after it's already on the court's docket?
So as far as a petitioner, I mean, we're always requesting remand, so that's usually something that goes to full briefing. But the government will generally, you know, what happens is they will look at a case and make a determination of whether they feel a remand is appropriate. So what I tend to do is that if I have a case where I think it's really clear that the board committed a legal error or something, some kind of an error or factual error, I will try to talk to the OIL attorney first to see if they will agree to a remand. And I have to say that's very infrequently happened. But then once we file the opening brief, a lot of times, I'm sure many of you have had this happen, Once you file the brief, then the OIL will come to you and say, we believe a remand is appropriate due to an error or possibly due to an intervening law. And so at that point, then you get to decide whether or not you think it's appropriate to remand the case, and then whether or not you have you want to waive fees or seek fees even though there's been a remand.
And I would say, I mean, it is sort of rare to get them to agree to remand, but I think I have had a few, and sometimes the errors are just glaring, and you just know what the Ninth Circuit's going to do on them. So I would encourage people, to raise the issues to OIL, but, you know, to just reach out to them and begin your conversation with them. They're very, you know, professional and pleasant people in my experience to work with, very reasonable to work with, and there aren't so many of them that if you start to do this work regularly, you're gonna see them, and you're gonna have various cases against them. And it's good. It's always easier to do the work when you have good relationships across the aisle and with your opponents.
When I was at the Office of Immigration Litigation, which was over a decade ago, the default was not to agree to a remand, I remember a case that I had in the Ninth Circuit where I went to the director and said, look, the board got it wrong here. It's an error. We should try to remand this back for them to get it right. If we go to the Ninth Circuit and I have to argue this case, we're going to lose. And the response was, the BIA is our client. We defend the BIA's decisions, go and defend it. So flew out to San Francisco, did the best argument I could in the case. Bob Job was the attorney on the other side, which was also not good for me, and we lost, as I expected we would, because we were wrong in the law. So I do sense, though, talking to OIL attorneys now and cases I've worked on, there's a little more willingness to agree to a remand in a case, like you say, where it's pretty clear that there was a legal error and you're not going to be successful in the petition. The other issue that I've seen come up is where the board realizes that the OIL realizes that the board got it wrong and they want to send it back, and yet you might want to keep it in the circuit court, particularly where it's an issue of law, where you'd like to get the court to issue a published decision, a precedent decision, in your favor. Have you all had that circumstance, and if so, how have you dealt with it?
I think that frequently is the issue. I mean, one thing to consider is that when you're approached by OIL for a motion to remand, you need to really look, would your client benefit? So a lot of times, even if you win at the Court of Appeals, you're getting a remand, right? So a lot of times that's fine, but if, you know, and you need to think about, okay, well, if we go back to the board, are they just going to issue a better decision that's going to make it harder to win on, right? But you also want to think, are you seeking termination? So, for instance, if you are arguing that your client's not deportable for a conviction at all, and it's an argument that the board does not have deference under Chevron, the Supreme Court decision for. So, for instance, a crime of violence, whether something's an aggravated felony crime of violence or the crime of violence ground under 237A2E, that is not something that the board has authority over, so there's no deference under Chevron. So you wouldn't necessarily want to remand in a case like that, because ultimately you want the court to resolve the issue de novo. So you really just need to think. Most of the time, to be honest, if I'm seeking a remand, I'll take a remand. And I would say in about 75% of cases, when the case gets remanded back to the board, it goes back to the IJ, for me at least. But not every case. A lot of times then I'm just bouncing back, or I get another decision from the board, and then I'm back up at the Court of Appeals again. So it's just every issue is different. Every case is different.
Okay, great. Here's another issue that's come up in recent years, which is prosecutorial discretion. How do either of you deal with a case where you think you want to seek prosecutorial discretion as a way of resolving the case rather than litigating it in the circuit court?
Yeah, I had a person who was, I thought, a great candidate, and in that instance, we began discussing in discussions as part of a mediation. But as Stacey had mentioned earlier, the very same discussion can take place without a mediation order. You can just pick up the phone. But in that case, we went back. In one case, there was a misunderstanding about my client's criminal history. So that was a good opportunity to point out that, that it wasn't what the oil attorney had thought it was. But nevertheless, they were unwilling to consider prosecutorial discretion. I think in that case, it's because my client was somebody who had a few prior removal orders and was had been, I hate to think this, but you know, had been litigating his case for a long time because he was part of this class of people that had applied for advance permission to reapply for admission back in the Perez Gonzalez 212A9C class, litigation dispute. And I think my sense was they just want the case to be done. But, you know, we went back and forth and we had discussions about what the facts were, and I, you know, they invited me to provide more evidence about a medical issue. So I think I felt like I got a fair audience. We ultimately disagreed, but I felt it was a worthwhile endeavor.
And I just learned from OIL that every case now, I believe, before being set for argument, at the Ninth Circuit at least, that OIL is reviewing the case for prosecutorial discretion. So they are seeking PD in a lot of cases, but then it's up to you as your client's advocate to decide if that's something that would benefit the client. So the most important thing to think about is the posture of your case. So if you've got a case that's on direct appeal, so let's say you lost asylum and you're up at the Court of Appeals and the OIL attorney says, you know, we'll offer prosecutorial discretion, and that would essentially mean a remand back to the board and administrative closure. Well, that's probably good for your client. Your client would qualify for a work permit and the case would be held in limbo. But if you have a case where it's a motion to reopen, or a reinstatement of removal, then typically what happens is OIL will want you to dismiss the petition for review, and then they would agree to some kind of, like, let's say a 1 or a 2 year stay, but your client would still have a removal order. And so you need to think about, is that good for your client? Because what's going to happen in 2 years? We haven't given the elections. I mean, we have no idea what's going to happen. And so are they basically giving up their rights in a full case for just 2 years here with no certainty? Now, in some cases, in cases of motions to reopen, I've been able to convince OIL to agree to remand the case back to the board and then to reopen for purposes of administrative closure and then admin close. Because if the case is just remanded, then there's no admin closure. So you need reopening for admin closure. And then finally, in cases of reinstatement of removal, in some circumstances, we've gotten OIL to communicate with ICE, so the local ICE office, to agree to rescind the reinstatement order and to issue a notice to appear and putting the person in proceedings before an immigration judge. And that's another form of prosecutorial discretion.
Yeah, and I've had that latter situation somewhat recently, too, on the reinstatement, agreeing to rescind the order. The other thing, like, I think the posture, yeah, considering the posture of a case is essential. Also considering, you know, the claim. So let's say you have three issues, right, and they're offering to remand in recognition of you prevailing on one of the issues. And if the other, you know, you need to decide what is the central issue that controls the life of the case. Because, you know, I think most cases can raise one or two, but there's really one you must win on for your client to ultimately succeed. And the rest are sort of collateral, and they're active today. And this is just part and parcel, I think, of being a litigator in an area of law that is so subject to change.
Okay, I think those are all good considerations. We're gonna move on, but if you look at the slides, it's important to keep in mind the first bullet point under remand considerations is what does your client want? So again, as the attorney, your duty is to consider all these different options. Consider what's the likelihood of success in the petition for review, and what do you get out of that? What does your client get out of that? What's the danger of dismissing? What's the likelihood of securing some sort of sustained, you know, secure status if you agree to a remand? And is a work permit sufficient for your client? Do they want something more enduring, like to eventually have the chance to get their green card? We lay out all these options, and then the client makes the decision, right? The client makes the call on what do they want to do. The next slide is returning the client after removal. Maria already touched on this. The and Ken debacle assurances that were made to the Supreme Court where it turned out there was actually no policy. So either of you have anything to say about the process of returning the client after removal? From my perspective, I always think of turning to people who've done this before or the practice advisories that AIC has prepared on returning a client after removal. There are other people who are experts on this. Have either of you had an experience where you've brought your client back to the U.S. after succeeding in the petition for review?
The first thing is good luck because it's hard even just to get anybody to pay attention. I think you can talk to the oil attorney in the case to try to get help, and we've given you on slide 20 a couple of emails for the ERO, prosecutorial discretion inquiries, and the public advocate. I recently used one of them, I used two of them, and one of them worked. I wasn't sure which one. But in general, I think that if you've got a hearing notice before an IJ, I think OIL's pretty okay in bringing somebody back. But I have a case now that's pending before the board, and it's just been taking 8 months, and the board's been sitting too, and so I don't have that hammer yet of the hearing notice. But typically, if there is a hearing notice, you can get them back in, then there's a whole question of how long it takes, and then what the costs are, and if they pay, and it's pretty difficult.
Yeah, the experience that I had was not facilitated by ERO, and it was facilitated by my client's persistence in going to the border with a hearing notice and CBP ultimately letting her in. So, talk to people who've done it from about, I think Holly Cooper has done it a number of times and some others, but just be prepared to make a fight, but definitely make it. They should help you bring the person back.
Creative ways to accomplish the objective. All right, before we run out of time, we wanted to touch on a few hot topics, which is the final substantive slide. Burden on proof and applications for relief, South Sata versus Lynch. Who wanted to discuss this?
I could mention quickly. So this is the issue of when you have an inconclusive record of conviction, who wins when somebody's applying for relief? Does the applicant for relief have an affirmative duty to prove a negative, to dispel, to prove that they don't have a conviction that makes them ineligible? And this is, of course, tied to the regulation that purports to assign burdens, 8 CFR 1240.AD. What I'll leave you with in our short time is this. Read South Sata. In our opinion, they get it right. Look at an AILA document. It's an amici brief. It's AILA number, document number 150111360. It will show you or walk you through how you make the argument that regulation cannot be read consistent with Supreme Court precedent to assign a burden of to assign the obligation to the applicant to disprove that they're not ineligible for relief. And then my last point on that is if you're losing on this issue before your IJ, to just preserve this issue. It's hot, it's evolving, and maybe it'll go our way ultimately.
South Sata is a terrific decision. I would recommend it to anybody, to read through and see how the argument was laid out and was successful before the court to really articulate why shifting the burden to the respondent in this type of case is inappropriate and why an indeterminate record should be sufficient to allow you to succeed.
Great.
Okay. The categorical approach, means versus elements, Mathis versus United States. Stacey?
Great. So just as a side note, by the way, we did not list U.S. versus Texas in there, but that's because you all know what's going on, and we're probably going to have a decision any day now within the next month or so on that as far as the DACA 2 program and DAPA and the president's authority to essentially issue deferred action. But as far as Mathis was another case that was argued right after the Texas case on April 26th before the Supreme Court. And it's not an immigration case, it involves a sentencing issue under the Armed Career Offenders Act, I believe, or the ACAA. I think I'm missing one of those. But it was a burglary case, and so the state statute at issue was broader than the federal because the burglary statute under the state allowed for burglary and entry into a structure which included vehicles, and that was not allowed under the generic federal definition of burglary. So the issue in Mathis overall is very big for us, and it's the means versus elements test. So this is a very complicated area of law, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, but essentially we're expecting the Supreme Court to really hopefully address this issue of whether or not when there's an element that's required for the generic definition, that the jury must, with unanimity, find that that element exists. And if it doesn't have to, then categorically the conviction does not meet the generic definition. So where this comes up, a prime example in the Ninth Circuit is the issue of theft. So under California law, theft can include either theft by larceny, which is without consent, or theft by embezzlement, which is false pretenses. But under the generic definition of theft, it must be without consent. So theft by false pretenses would not meet the generic definition of theft. But under California law, a jury does not have to decide with unanimity whether or not the property taken was either without consent or it was by false pretenses. Either is fine. And so because of that, the Ninth Circuit had found that California theft categorically does not meet the general definition of theft. And so, therefore, every California theft is now not an aggravated felony. And you can see how expansive these findings are. Just in the Ninth Circuit alone, we have findings that child pornography is not an aggravated felony, that firearms offenses do not meet the generic definition. And so Mathis, while not an immigration case, will hopefully get some clarification on this issue.
Terrific. One other case to mention, recently issued Supreme Court decision in a case called Luna Torres versus Lynch, just decided on May 19th, where the Luna Torres had argued that his particular conviction, his state conviction, didn't qualify as an aggravated felony. It was an arson offense because the statute requires that the offense be described in a specific federal statute or by generic label. The argument was that because the state offense lacked the element of connection to interstate or foreign commerce, it didn't qualify as an aggravated felony that was described in. The Supreme Court considered that argument and rejected it and held that the element of involvement in interstate commerce was a jurisdictional element, not a substantial element that would have prevented it from qualifying as an aggravated felony, concluded that a state offense that describes the equivalent of a federal statute, in this case, an arson crime, does not have to have a connection to interstate commerce to qualify as an aggravated felony. Therefore, Luna Torres had been convicted of an aggravated felony and lost before the Supreme Court.
Great. And just a quick comment on that. I don't think that the holding in Luna Torres was really any surprise for anybody, but one thing that concerned me when I was reading it is that the court kept saying over and over, you know, under this reading, then all of these convictions would not be deportable offenses, and sort of the floodgates type of concern. And it's very interesting because thinking about Mathis, like that's really one thing that's going to be very relevant in Mathis, because as you can see that as the categorical approach gets applied more and more to state statutes, we see more and more that convictions are categorically not deportable offenses.
Yeah, the court's concern in Luna Torres was that some of the gravest crimes, as they say, described in the aggravated felony definition, for example, most child pornography offenses under Luna Torres' reading would not qualify as aggravated felonies because they wouldn't have that federal element, that federal hook, and the court was very concerned about that consequence. So stay tuned to see what happens in Mathis and obviously in United States versus Texas or Texas versus United States. And I think that pretty much is all of our time. Thank you, everybody, for listening to our podcast today. I'll turn it back over to JJ for a final wrap-up.
Thank you. Thanks, Thomas. For those of you who will be seeking CLE credit for your participation in this podcast, please make note of the following four-digit attendance verification code. The four-digit code is 4603. Again, the code is 4603. Please visit AILA's WebCLE Center at www.ailawebcle.org to record your CLE credit. Thank you very much to all of our speakers for sharing their knowledge and expertise, and to you for joining us today. That concludes our podcast.